place where he and his family were alien and yet had forged a life. He misses the marble-floored halls and red lacquer pillars of his ancestral home, ringing with the calls of his children and grandchildren and servants. He misses Hainan chicken and laksa asam and good sweet kopi and roti canai. He misses his clipper fleet and the crews. And isn't it true that he hired even the brown people for his crews, even had them as captains, who sailed his Mishimoto clippers to the far side of the world, sailing even as far as Europe, carrying tea strains resistant to Gene Hackweevil and returning with expensive cognacs that had not been seen since the days of the expansion. And in the evenings, he returned to his wives and ate well and worried only that a son was not diligent or that a daughter would find a good husband. How silly and ignorant he had been. He fancied himself a sea trader, and yet understood so little of the turning tides. A young girl emerges from under a tarp flap. She smiles at him, too young to know him for a stranger, and too innocent yet to care. She is alive, burning with the limber vitality that an old man can only envy with every aching bone. She smiles at him. She could be his daughter. Malaya's night was black and sticky, a jungle filled with the squawks of nightbirds and the pulse and whir of insect life. Dark harbor waters lapped before them. He and fourth daughter, that useless waif, the only one he could preserve, hid among piers and rocking boats, and when darkness fell completely, he guided her down to the water, to where waves rushed onto the beach in steady surges, and the stars overhead were pinpricks of gold and blackness.
"Look, Ba. Gold," she whispered.
There were times when he told her that every star was a bit of gold that was hers for the taking, because she was Chinese, and with hard work and attendance to her ancestors and traditions, she would prosper. And now, here they were under a blanket of gold dust. The Milky Way spread over them like some great shifting blanket. The stars so thick that if he were tall enough he could reach up and squeeze them and have them run down his arms. Gold, all around, and all of it untouchable. Amid the lapping of fishing boats and little spring craft, he found a rowboat and pulled for deep water, aiming for the bay, following the currents, a black speck on the shifting reflections of the ocean. He would have preferred a cloudy night, but at least there was no moon, and so he pulled and pulled, while all around them sea carp surfaced and rolled, showing the fat, pale bellies that people of his clan had engineered to feed a starving nation. He pulled on the oars and the carp surrounded them, showing bloated stomachs now thickened on the blood and gristle of their creators. And then his little boat was alongside the object of his search, a trimaran anchored in the deep, the place where Hafiz's boat people slept. He climbed aboard and slipped silent among them, studying them all as they slept soundly, protected by their religion, safe and alive, while he had nothing. His arms and shoulders and back ached from the strain of rowing, an old man's aches, a soft man's pains. He slipped among them, searching, too old for the nonsense survival, and yet unable to give it up. He might still survive. The one daughter mouth might survive, even if she was a girl child. Even if she would do nothing for her ancestors, at least she was of his clan. A clipping of DNA that still might be saved. Finally, he found the body he wanted, leaned down and touched it gently, covered the man's mouth.
"Old friend," he whispered.
The man's eyes went wide as he awoke.
"Ensik Tan."
He nearly saluted, even half naked and lying on his back, and then, As if recognizing the change in their fortunes, his hand fell back and he addressed Hak Sung as he had never dared in real life.
Hak Sung, you're still alive.
Hak Sung pursed his lips.
This useless daughter mouth and I need to go north. I need your help.
Hafiz sat up, rubbing his eyes. He glanced furtively at the rest of his sleeping clan. He whispered,
If I turned you in, I would make a fortune. The head of 3 prosperities? I would be rich.
You were not poor when you worked with me.
Your head is worth more than all the Chinese skulls stacked in the streets of Penang. And I would be safe.
Hak Sung started to respond angrily, but Hafiz put his hand up, indicating silence. He ushered Hak Sung to the edge of the deck against the rail. He leaned close, his lips nearly touching Hak Sung's ear.
Do you not know the danger you bring on me? Some of my own family wear green headbands now. My own sons. It is not safe here. You think this is something I just learned now?
Hafiz had the grace to look away, embarrassed.
I cannot help you.
Hak Sung grimaced.
Is this what my kindness to you has earned? Did I not attend your wedding? Gift you and Rana well? Fet you for 10 days? Did I not pay for Muhammad's admission to college in KL?
You did that and more. My debts to you are great.
Hafiz bowed his head.
But we are not the men we were before. The green headbands are everywhere among us, and those of us who loved the yellow plague can only suffer. Your head would buy my family security. I'm sorry. It is true. I don't know why I don't strike you now.
I have diamonds. Jade.
Hafiz sighed and turned away, showing his broad, muscled back.
If I took your jewels, I would just as quickly be tempted to take your life. If we speak of money, then your head must always be the most valuable prize. Best not to discuss the temptations of wealth.
So this is how we end.
Hafiz turned back to Hak Sung, pleading.
Tomorrow, I will give your clipper ship Dawnstar to them and forswear you utterly. If I was smart, I would turn you in as well. All the ones who have aided the Yellow Plague are suspected now. We, who fattened on Chinese industry and thrived under your generosity, are the most hated in our new Malaya. The country is not the same as it was. People are hungry. They are angry. They call us all calorie pirates, profiteers, and yellow dogs. There is nothing to quell it. Your blood is already shed, but they have yet to decide what to do with us. I cannot risk my family for you. You could come north with us. Sail together.
Hafiz sighed.
The green headbands already sail the coast searching for refugees. Their net is wide and deep, and they slaughter those they catch.
But we are clever. More clever than they. We could slip past.
No. It is impossible.
How do you know?
Hafiz looked away, embarrassed.
My sons spoke to me.
Hak Sung scowled bitterly, holding his granddaughter's hand. Hafiz said,
I'm sorry. My shame will go with me until I die.
He turned abruptly and hurried for the galley. He returned with unspoiled mangoes and papaya, a bag of Utex, a Perkal Sibi melon.
Here, take these. I'm sorry I can do no more. I'm sorry. I have to think of my own survival as well.
And with that, he ushered Hak-Sung off the boat and out into the waves. A month later, Hak-Sung crossed the border alone, crawling through leech-infested jungle, after being abandoned by the snakeheads who betrayed them. Hak-Sung has heard that those who helped the yellow people later died in droves, plunging from cliffs into the sea to swim as best they could for the shore's smashing rocks, or shot where they floated. He wonders often if Hafiz was one of those to die, or if his gift of the last of three prosperities, unscuttled clippers, was enough to save his family. If his green headband sons spoke for him, or if they watched coldly as their father suffered for his many, many sins.
Grandfather, are you well?
The little girl touches Hak-Sung gently on the wrist, watching him with wide black eyes.
My mother can get you boiled water if you need to drink.
Hak-Sung starts to speak, then simply nods and turns away. If he speaks to her, she will know him for a refugee. Best that he simply blend in. Best not to reveal that he lives amongst them, at the whim of white shirts and the dung lord, and a few faked stamps on his yellow card. Best to trust no one, even if they seem friendly. A smiling girl one day is a girl with a stone, bashing in the brains of a baby the next.
This is the only truth.
One can think there are such things as loyalty and trust and kindness, but they are devil cats. In the end, they are only smoke and cannot be grasped. Another 10 minutes of twisting passages carries him close to the city's seawalls, where hovels attach themselves like barnacles to the ramparts of revered King Rama the XII's blueprint for the survival of his city. Hak-Sung finds Laughing Chan sitting beside a jock cart, eating a steaming bowl of Yutek's rice porridge, with small bits of unidentifiable meat buried in the paste. In his last life, Laughing Chan was a plantation overseer, tapping the trunks of rubber trees to capture latex drippings, a crew of 150 under him. In this life, his flair for organization has found a new niche, running laborers to unload megadons and clipper ships down on the docks and out on the anchor pads when ties are too lazy or thick or slow, or he can bribe someone higher up to let his yellow card crew have the rice. And sometimes, he does other work as well. Moves opium and the amphetamine yaba from the river into the dung lord's very own towers. Slips Agrigen Soypro in from Koh Angrit, despite the Environment Ministry's blockades. He's missing an ear and 4 teeth, but that doesn't stop him from smiling. He sits and grins like a fool and shows the gaps in his teeth, and all the while his eyes roam over the passing pedestrian traffic. Hak-Sung sits and another bowl of steaming jock is set before him, and they eat the Yutek's gruel with coffee that is almost as good as what they used to drink down south, and all the while both of them watch the people all around, their eyes following the woman who serves them from her pot, the men crouched at the other tables in the alley, the commuters squeezing past with their bicycles. The two of them are yellow cards, after all. It is as much in their nature as a Cheshire's search for birds.
You ready?
Laughing Chan asks.
A little longer yet. I don't want your men to be seen.
Don't worry. We almost walk like ties now.
He grins in his gap show.
We're going native.
You know, dog fucker.
Laughing Chan nods sharply and his smile disappears.
And Sukrat knows me. I will be below the seawall, village side, out of sight.
I have Ah Ping and Peter Sue to watch close.
Good then.
Hak Sung finishes his jock and pays for Laughing Chan's food as well. With Laughing Chan and his men nearby, Hak Sung feels a little better. But still, it is a risk. If this thing goes wrong, Laughing Chan will be too far away to do much more than effect vengeance. And really, when Hak Sung thinks about it, he isn't sure he is paid enough for that. Laughing Chan saunters off, slipping between tarp structures. Hak Sung continues on through the stagnant heat to the steep, rough path that runs up the side of the seawall. He climbs up through the slums, his knee aching with every step. Eventually, he reaches the high, broad embankment of the city's tidal defenses. After the sheltered stink of the slums, the sea breeze, rushing over him and tugging at his clothes, is a relief. The bright blue ocean reflects like a mirror. Others stand on the embankment's promenade, taking the fresh air. In the distance, one of King Rama the XII's coal pumps squats like a massive toad on the embankment's edge. The symbol for Korakut, the crab, is visible in its metal hide. Steam and smoke gout from its stacks in steady puffs. Somewhere, deep underground, organized by the genius of the king, the pumps send their tendrils and suck water from beneath so that the city will not drown. Even in the hot season, seven pumps run steadily, keeping Bangkok from being swallowed. In the rainy season, all 12 of the zodiac signs run as the rain drenches down and everyone pulls the thoroughfares of the city in skiffs, skin-soaked, grateful that the monsoon hasn't failed and that the seawalls haven't broken. He makes his way down the other side and out on a dock. A farmer with a skiff full of coconuts offers him one, slashing open the green top for Hak Sung to drink. Across the waters, the drowned buildings of Tonburi poke up through the waves. Skiffs and fishing nets and clipper ships slip back and forth in the water. Hak Sung takes a deep breath, sucking the smell of salt and fish and seaweed deep into his lungs. The life of the ocean. A Japanese clipper slides past, palm oil polymer hull and high white sails like a gull's. The hydrofoil package below it is still hidden, but once it's out in the water, it will use its spring cannon to launch its high sails, and then the ship will leap up from the water like a fish. Hak Sung remembers standing on the deck of his own first clipper, its high sails flying, slashing across the ocean like a stone skipped by a child, laughing as they tore over the waves as spray rushed and blasted him. He had turned to his number one wife and told her that all things were possible, that the future was theirs. He settles himself in the shoreline and drinks the rest of the green coconut water while a beggar boy watches. Hak Sung beckons. This one is smart enough, he supposes. He likes to reward the smart ones, the ones who are patient enough to linger and see what he will do with a coconut husk. He hands it to the boy. The boy takes it with a Y and goes to smash it on the mortared stones at the top of the seawall. Then he squats and uses a scrap of oyster shell to scrape the slimy, tender meat from the interior. Starving. Eventually, Dogfucker arrives. His real name is Sukrit Kamsing, but Hak Sung seldom hears the man's true name on the lips of yellow cards. There is too much bile and history built up. Instead, it's always Dogfucker, and the words drip with hate and fear. He's a squat man, full of calories and muscle. As perfect for his work as a megadont is for converting calories into joules. The scars on his hands and arms show pale. The slits, where his nose once stood, stare at Hak Sung. Two dark, vertical nostril slashes that give him a porcine appearance. There is some argument among yellow cards about whether Dogfucker let Fagan run too long, allowing its cauliflower growths to send enough tendrils deep into his flesh that doctors were forced to chop the whole thing off to save his life. Or if the dung lord simply took his nose to teach him a lesson. Dogfucker squats beside Hak-Sung, hard black eyes.
Your Dr. John came to me with a letter.
Hak-Sung nods.
I want to meet with your patron.
Dogfucker laughs slightly.
I broke her fingers and fucked her dead for interrupting my nap.
Hak-Sung keeps his face impassive. Maybe Dogfucker is lying. Maybe he's telling the truth. It is impossible to know. Regardless, it is a tease. To see if Hak-Sung will flinch. To see if he will bargain. Perhaps Dr. Chan is gone. Another name to weigh him down when he finally reincarnates. Hak-Sung says,
Your patron will look favorably on the offer, I think.
Dogfucker scratches absently at the slit of a nostril.
Why not meet me at my office instead?
I like open places.
You have people around here. More yellow cards? You think they'll make you safe?
Hak-Sung shrugs. He looks out at the ships and their sails, at the wide world beckoning.
I want to offer you and your patron a deal. A mountain of profit.
Tell me what it is.
Hak-Sung shakes his head.
No. I must speak with him in person. Him only.
He doesn't talk to yellow cards. Maybe I'll just feed you to the red fin pla out there. Just like the green headbands did with your kind down south.
You know who I am.
I know who your letter says you were.
Dogfucker rubs at the edges of his nose slits, studying Hak-Sung.
Here, you're just another yellow card.
Hak-Sung doesn't say anything. He hands the hemp sack of money across to Dogfucker. Dogfucker eyes it suspiciously, doesn't take it.
What is it?
A gift. Look and see.
Dogfucker is curious, but also cautious. It's a good thing to know. He isn't the sort to put his hand in a bag and come up with a scorpion. Instead, he loosens the sack and dumps it. Bundles of cash spill out, roll in the shells and dirt of a low tide. Dogfucker's eyes widen. Hak-Sung keeps himself from smiling.
Tell the Dung Lord that Tan Hak-Sung, head of the Three Prosperities Trading Company, has a business proposal. Deliver my note to him and you will also profit greatly.
Dogfucker smiles.
I think perhaps that I'll simply take this money and my men will beat you until you tell me where you hide all your paranoid yellow card cash.
Hak-Sung doesn't say anything, keeps his face impassive. Dogfucker says,
I know all about Laughing Chan's people here. He owes me for his disrespect.
Hak-Sung is surprised that he feels no fear. He lives in fear of all things, but thuggish Pelian, like Dogfucker, are not what fill his nights with terror. In the end, Dogfucker is a businessman. He is not a white shirt, puffed on national pride, or hungry for a little more respect. Dogfucker works for money, acts for money. He and Hak-Sung are different parts of the economic organism, but underneath everything, they are brothers. Hak-Sung smiles slightly as confidence builds.
This is just a gift for your trouble. What I propose will provide much more for all of us.
He takes out the last two items, one a letter.
Give it to your master, sealed.
The other he hands across, A small box with its familiar universal spindle and braces, a palm oil polymer casing in a dull shade of yellow. Dogfucker takes the object, turns it over.
A kink spring?
He makes a face.
What's the point of this?
Hawksung smiles.
He'll know when he reads the letter.
He stands and turns away, without even waiting for Dogfucker to respond, feeling stronger and more assured than any time since the green headbands came and his warehouses went up in smoke, and his clipper ships went sliding down into the ocean depths. In this moment, Hawksung feels like a man. He walks straighter, his limp forgotten. It's impossible to know if Dogfucker's people will follow him, and so he walks slowly, knowing that both Dogfucker's and Laughing Chan's men surround him, a floating ring of surveillance, as he works his way down the alleys and cuts into deeper slums, until at last Laughing Chan is there, waiting for him, smiling.
They let you go, he says.
Hawksung pulls out more money.
You did well. He knows it was your men, though.
He gives Laughing Chan an extra roll of baht.
Pay him off with this.
Laughing Chan smiles at the pile of money.
This is twice what I need for that. Even Dogfucker likes to use us, when he doesn't want to risk smuggling Soypro over from Koh Angrit.
Take it anyway.
Laughing Chan shrugs and pockets it.
It's very kind of you. With the anchor pad shut down, we can use the extra baht.
Hawksung is turning away, but at Laughing Chan's words, he turns back.
What did you say about the anchor pads?
They're shut down. The white shirts raided them last night. Everything's locked tight.
What happened?
Laughing Chan shrugs.
I heard they burned everything. Sent it all up in smoke.
Hawksung doesn't pause to ask any more. He turns and runs as fast as his old bones will carry him, cursing himself all the way, cursing that he was a fool and didn't put his nose to the wind, that he let himself be distracted from bare survival by the urgent wish to do something more, to reach ahead. Every time he makes plans for his future, he seems to fail. Every time he reaches forward, the world leans against him, pressing him down. On Tanon Sukhumvit, in the sweat of the sun, he finds a news vendor. He fumbles through newspapers and the hand-cranked whisper sheets of rumor, through luck pages, advertising good numbers for gambling, and the names of predicted Muay Thai champions. He tears them open, one after another, more frantic with every copy. All of them show the smiling face of Jaidi Rojanasukchai, the incorruptible tiger of Bangkok. Chapter 7.
Look, I'm famous.
Jaidi holds the whisper sheet picture up beside his own face, grinning at Kanya. When she doesn't smile, he puts it back in its rack, along with all the rest of his pictures.
Ah, you're right. It's not really a good likeness. They must have bribed it out of our records department.
He sighs wistfully.
But I was young then.
Still, Kanya doesn't respond, just stares morosely at the water of the Glong. They've spent the day hunting for skiffs smuggling percal and agrigen crops up the river, sailing back and forth across the river mouth, and Jaidi still thrums with a certain exhilaration. The prize of the day was a clipper ship anchored just off the docks. Ostensibly an Indian trading vessel sailed north from Bali, it turned out to be brimming with proboscis-resistant pineapples. It was satisfying to see the harbormaster and the ship's captain both stammering excuses while Jaidi's white shirts poured lye over the entire shipment, crate after crate, rendered sterile and inedible, All that smuggling profit. Gone. He flips through the other papers attached to the display board, finds a different image of himself. This one from his time as a Muay Thai competitor, laughing after a fight in Lumpini Stadium. The Bangkok Morning Post. My boys will like this one. He opens the paper and scans the story. Trade Minister Akarat is spitting mad. The quotes from the trade ministry call Jaidi a vandal. Jaidi is surprised they don't just call him a traitor or a terrorist. That they restrain themselves tells him just how impotent they really are. Jaidi can't help smiling over the pages at Kanya. We really hurt them. Again, Kanya doesn't respond. There's a certain trick to ignoring her bad moods. The first time Jaidi met Kanya, he almost thought she was stupid. The way her face remained so impassive, so impervious to any hint of fun, as though she were missing an organ. A nose for smell, eyes for sight, and whatever curious organ makes a person sense sanuk when it is right in front of them.
We should be getting back to the ministry, she says,
and turns to scan the boat traffic along the Klong, looking for a possible ride. Jaidi pays the whisper sheet man for his paper as a canal taxi glides into view. Kanya flags it and it slides up beside them, its flywheel whining with accumulated power, waves sloshing the Klong embankment as its wake catches up. Huge kink springs crowd half its displacement. Wealthy Chaozhou Chinese business people cram the covered prow of the boat like ducks on their way to slaughter. Kanya and Jaidi jump aboard and stand on the running board outside the seating compartment. The ticket child ignores their white uniforms, just as they ignore her. She sells a 30-baht ticket to another man who boards with them. Jaidi grabs a safety line as the boat accelerates away from the dock. Wind caresses his face as they make their way down the Klong, aiming for the heart of the city. The boat moves quickly, zipping around small padded skiffs and long-tail boats in the canal. Blocks of dilapidated houses and shopfronts slide past. Pasin and blouses and sarong hang colorful in the sun. Women bathe their long black hair in the brown waters of the canal. The boat slows abruptly. Kanya looks forward.
What is it?
Up ahead, a tree has fallen, blocking much of the canal. Boats jam around it, trying to squeeze past. A bow tree, Jaidi says. He looks around for landmarks. We'll have to let the monks know. No one else will move it. And despite the shortage of wood, no one will harvest it either. It would be unlucky. Their boat wallows as the Klong traffic tries to slip through the tiny gap left in the canal where the sacred tree has not blocked movement. Jaidi makes a noise of impatience and then calls ahead. Clear out, friends! Ministry business! Clear the way! He waves his badge. The sight of the badge and his bright white uniform is enough to get boats and skiffs poling aside. The pilot of their taxi flashes Jaidi a grateful look. Their kink spring craft slips into the press, jostling for space. As they ease around the bare branches of the tree, the Klong taxi's passengers all make deep whys of respect to the fallen trunk, pressing their palms together and touching them to their foreheads. Jaidi makes his own why, then reaches out to touch the wood, letting his fingers slide over the riddled surface as they pass. Small boreholes speckle it. If he were to peel away the bark, a fine net of grooves would describe the tree's death. A bow tree. Sacred. The tree under which the Buddha attained enlightenment. And yet they could do nothing to save it. Not a single varietal of fig survived, despite their best efforts. The ivory beetles were too much for them. When the scientists failed, they prayed to Prasub Nakasatian, a last desperate effort, but even the martyr couldn't save them in the end.
We couldn't save everything,
Kanya murmurs, seeming to read his thoughts. We couldn't save even one thing, Jaidi lets his fingers slide along the grooves where the ivory beetle did its work.
The Farang have so much to answer for, and yet still Akarat seeks to treat with them.
Not with Agrajan.
Jaidi smiles bitterly and pulls his hand away from the fallen tree.
No, not with them. But their ilk, nonetheless. Gene rippers, calorie men. Even per cal when the famines are worst.
Why else do we let them squat on Koh Angrit?
In case we need them. In case we fail and must go begging for their rice and wheat and soy.
We have our own gene rippers now.
Thanks to His Royal Majesty King Rama the XII's foresight.
And Chao Phraya Gibusen.
Chao Phraya.
Jaidi makes a face.
No one that evil should be graced with such a respectful title.
Kanya shrugs but doesn't bait him. Soon the bow tree is behind them. At Srinakarin Bridge, they disembark. The smell of food stalls calls to Jaidi. He motions Kanya to follow as he makes his way into a tiny soy.
Somchai says there's a good somtom cart down here. Good clean papayas, he tells me.
I'm not hungry, Kanya says.
That's why you're always in such a terrible mood.
Jaidi.
Kanya starts, then stops. Jaidi glances back at her, catches the worried expression on her face.
What is it? Come on, then.
I'm worried about the anchor pads.
Jaidi shrugs.
Don't be.
Up ahead, food carts and tables cluster along the walls of the alley, all jammed together. Small bowls of nam plaprik sit tidily in the centers of the scavenged table planks.
You see? Somchai was right.
He finds the salad cart he wants and examines the spices and fruit, starts ordering for both of them. Kanya comes up beside, a compact cloud of dark mood.
200,000 baht is a lot of money for Akarat to lose,
she mutters, as Jaidi tells the somtom vendor to add more chilies. Jaidi nods thoughtfully as the woman stirs the threads of green papaya into the mix of spices.
It's true. I had no idea there was so much money being made out there.
It's enough to finance a new lab for gene rip research. Or put 500 white shirts on inspection in the tilapia farms of Tonburi. He shakes his head. And this was just one raid. It's amazing to him. There are times when he thinks he understands how the world works, and then, every so often, he lifts the lid of some new part of the Divine City and finds roaches scuttling where he never expected. Something new indeed. He goes to the next food cart, stacked with trays of chili-laden pork and red star bamboo tips. Fried snakehead pla, battered and crisp, pulled from the Chao Phraya River that day. He orders more food, enough for both of them, and sato for drinking. He settles at an open table as the food is brought out. Teetering on a bamboo stool at the end of his day, with rice beer warming his belly, Jaidi can't help smiling at his doer subordinate. As usual, even with good food before her, Kanya remains herself.
Kun Birom Bhakti was complaining about you at headquarters, she says. He said he would go to General Pracha and have your smiling lips ripped off.
Jaidi scoops chilies into his mouth. I'm not afraid of him.
The anchor pads were supposed to be his territory. His protection racket, his bribe money.
First you worry about trade, now you worry about Birum Bhakti. That old man is afraid of his own shadow. He makes his wife taste every dish for him to make sure he won't get blister rust.
He shakes his head.
Stop being so sour. You should smile more. Laugh a little. Here, drink this.
Jaidi pours more sato for his lieutenant.
We used to call our country the land of smiles.
Jaidi demonstrates.
And there you sit, sad-faced, as though you're eating limes all day.
Perhaps we had more to smile about then.
Well, that might be true. Jadi sets his sato back on the splintered tabletop and stares at it thoughtfully. We must have done something terrible in our previous lives to have earned these ones. It's the only thing I can think of that explains it all. Kanya sighs.
I sometimes see my grandmother's spirit, wandering around the chedi near my house. She told me one time that she couldn't reincarnate until we made a better place for her to arrive.
Another of the contraction, P. How did she find you? Wasn't she Isan people, too?
She found me anyway.
Kanya shrugs.
She is very unhappy with me.
Yes, well, I suppose we'll be unhappy, too. Jaidi has seen these ghosts as well, walking the boulevard sometimes, sitting in the trees. P are everywhere now. Too many to count. He has seen them in the graveyards, and leaning against the bones of riddled bow trees, all of them looking at him with some irritation. Mediums all speak of how crazy with frustration the PR, how they cannot reincarnate and thus linger, like a great mass of people at Hualampong Station hoping for a train ride down to the beaches. All of them waiting for a reincarnation that they cannot have, because none of them deserve the suffering of this particular world. Monks like Ajahn Sutep say this is nonsense. He sells amulets to ward off these P, and says that they are nothing but hungry ghosts, created by the unnatural death of eating from blister-rust-tainted vegetables. Anyone can go to his shrine and make a donation, or else go to the Erewhon shrine and make an offering to Brahma. Perhaps have the temple dancers perform for a little while, and by a hope that the spirits may be put to rest to travel on to their next incarnation. It is possible to hope for such things. Still, the ghosts are all around. Everyone agrees on that. The victims of Agrigen and Perkal and all their ilk. Jaidi says, I wouldn't take it personally about your grandmother. On the full moon, I've seen the P crowding the roads around the Environment Ministry, too. Many dozens of them. He smiles sadly. It's really impossible to fix, I think. When I think about Niwat and Surat growing up with this... He takes a breath, fighting back more emotion than he cares to show before Kanya. Takes another drink. Anyway... The fight is good. I just wish we can get hold of some Agrigen or Perkal executives and throttle them. Maybe give them a taste of Blister Rust AG-134S. Then my life would be complete. I could die happy.
You probably won't reincarnate either, Kanya observes. You're too good to end up in this hell again.
If I'm lucky, I'll be reborn in Des Moines and bomb their gene rib labs.
If only.
Jaidi looks up at Kanya's tone. What's bothering you? Why so sad? We'll both be reborn somewhere beautiful, I'm sure. Both of us. Think of all the merit we earned just last night. I thought those customs Hia were going to shit themselves when we burned the cargo. Kanya makes a bitter face.
They've probably never met a white shirt they couldn't bribe.
And as quick as that, she kills his attempt at good humor. No wonder no one likes her at the ministry. No, that's true. Everyone takes bribes now. It's not like before. People don't remember the worst times. They aren't afraid the way they were before.
And now you dive down the cobra's throat with trade, Kanya says. After the December 12th coup, it seems as if General Pracha and Minister Akarat are always circling one another, looking for a new excuse to fight. They never finished their feud, and now you do something to further anger Akarat. It makes things unstable.
Well, I was always too gyron for my own good. Chaya complains about it too. That's why I keep you around. I wouldn't worry about Akarat, though. He'll spit for a while, then he'll calm down. He may not like it, but General Pracha has too many allies in the army for another coup attempt.
With Prime Minister Surawang dead, Akarat really has nothing left. He's isolated. Without megadons and tanks to back up his threats, Akarat may be rich, but he's a paper tiger.
This is a good lesson for him.
He's dangerous.
Jaidi looks at her seriously. So are cobras. So are megadons. So is Sibiscosis. We're surrounded by dangers. Akarat. Jaidi shrugs. Anyway, it's already done. There's nothing you can do to change it.
Why worry now? Mai Peng Rai.
Never mind.
Still, you should be careful.
You're thinking of that man at the anchor pads. The one Somchai saw. Did he frighten you? Kanya shrugs.
No.
I'm surprised. He frightened me. Jaidi watches Kanya, wondering how much he should say, how much he should reveal that he knows about the world around him. I have a very bad feeling about him.
Really?
Kanya looks distressed.
You're frightened? Of one stupid man?
Jaidi shakes his head. Not afraid so that I will run and hide behind Chaya's passing, but still. I've seen him before.
You didn't tell me.
I wasn't sure at first. Now I am. I think he's with trade. He pauses, testing. I think they're hunting me again. Maybe considering another assassination. What do you think of that?
They wouldn't dare touch you.
Her Majesty the Queen has spoken in your favor. Jaidi touches his neck, with the old spring gun scar still shows light on his dark skin.
Not even after what I did to them at the anchor pads?
Kanya bridles.
I'll assign a bodyguard.
Jaidi laughs at her fierceness and is warmed and reassured by it. You're a good girl, but I'd be a fool to take a bodyguard. Then everyone would know that I can be frightened. That's not the way of a tiger. Here, eat this. He scoops more snakehead plaw onto Kanya's plate.
I'm full.
Don't be so polite. Eat.
You should have a bodyguard, please.
I'll trust you to guard my back. You should be more than enough. Kanya flinches. Jaidi hides a smile at her discomfort. Ah, Kanya, he thinks. We all have choices we must face in life. I've made mine. But you have your own karma. He speaks gently. Go on and eat more. You look skinny. How will you find a special friend if you're only bones? Kanya pushes her plate away.
I don't eat much these days, it seems.
People are starving everywhere and you can't eat. Kanya makes a face and scoops a sliver of fish onto her spoon. Jaidi shakes his head. He sets down his own fork and spoon. What is it? You're even more glum than usual. I feel like we've just put one of your brothers in a funeral urn. What's bothering you?
It's nothing, really. Just not hungry.
Speak up, Lieutenant. I want straight talk from you. It's an order. You're a good officer. I can't stand having your sad face. I don't like any of my people to be sad-faced. Even the ones from Isan. Kanya grimaces. Jaidi watches as his lieutenant mulls what she will say. He wonders if he was ever so tactful as this young woman. He doubts it. He has always been too brash, too easily angered. Not like Kanya, doer Kanya, all Jayen all the time. Not Sanuk at all, but certainly Jayen. He waits, thinking that at last he will hear her story, her full story in all its painful humanity. But when Kanya finally summons the words, she surprises him. She speaks in a near whisper, almost too embarrassed to form the words at all.
Some of the men complain that you don't take enough gifts of goodwill.
What? Jaidi sits back, goggles at her. We won't participate in that sort of thing. We're different than the rest, and proud of it.
Kanya nods readily.
And the newspapers and whisper sheets love you for it. And the people love you for it.
But? Her miserable look returns.
But you don't get promoted anymore. And the men who are loyal to you get no help from your patronage, and they lose heart.
But look what we accomplish!
Jaidi takes the sack of money between his legs that they confiscated off the clipper ship.
They all know that if they have a need, they will be helped. We have more than enough for anyone in need.
Kanya looks down at the table and mumbles.
Some say you like to keep the money.
What?
Jaidi stares at her dumbstruck. Do you think this? Kanya shrugs, miserably.
Of course not.
Jaidi shakes his head, apologizing.
No, of course you wouldn't. You've been a good girl. You've done great things here.
He smiles at his lieutenant, almost overwhelmed with compassion for the young woman who came to him starving, idolizing him in his years as a champion, wanting so much to emulate him.
I do what I can to squash the rumors, but...
Kanya shrugs again. Miserable.
Cadets say that being under Captain Jaidi is like starving of aka worms. You work and get skinnier and skinnier. These are good boys we have, but they can't help but feel ashamed when they have old uniforms and their comrades have new crisp ones. When they ride a bicycle two at a time and their comrades ride kink spring scooters.
Jaidi sighs. I remember a time when the white shirts were loved.
Everyone needs to eat.
Jaidi sighs again. He pulls the satchel out from between his legs and shoves it across to Kanya. Take the money. Divide it equally amongst them for their bravery and hard work yesterday. She looks at him surprised.
You're sure?
Jaidi shrugs and smiles, hiding his own disappointment, knowing that this is the best way, and yet saddened immeasurably by it. Why not? They're good boys, as you say. And it's not as though the Farang and the Ministry of Trade aren't reeling at this very moment. They did good work.
Kanya wise deep respect, ducking her head low and raising her pressed palms to her forehead.
Oh, stop that nonsense. Jaidi pours more sato into Kanya's glass, finishing the bottle. My pen rai, never mind. These are small things. Tomorrow, we'll have new battles to fight. And we'll need good, loyal boys to follow us. How will we ever overcome the Agrajans and Perkals of the world if we don't feed our friends?
Chapter 8.
I lost 30,000.
50.
Otto mutters. Lucy Wen stares at the ceiling.
185, 6.
400.
Coyle Napier sets his warm glass of Sato down on the low table.
I lost 400,000 blue bills on Carlyle's goddamn dirigible.
The entire table falls silent, stunned.
Christ.
Lucy sits up, bleary with drink in the middle of the afternoon.
What were you smuggling in? Sibby-resistant seed stock?
The conversationalists sprawl on the veranda of Sir Francis Drake's, all five together. The Farang Phalanx, as Lucy has styled them. All of them staring out at the dry season blast furnace and drinking themselves into a stupor. Anderson reclines with them, half listening to their slurred complaints as he turns the problem of the Gnaw's origins over in his mind. He's got another bag of the fruit between his feet, and he can't help thinking that the answer to his puzzle lies close, if only he had sufficient ingenuity to suss it out. He drinks warm Khmer whiskey and ponders.
Gnaw.
Apparently impervious to blister rust and sibiscosis, even when directly exposed. Obviously resistant to Nippon genehack weevil and leaf curl, or could never have grown. A perfect product. The fruit of access to different genetic material than Agrigen and the rest of the calorie companies use for their gene ripping. Somewhere in this country, a seed bank is hidden. Thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of carefully preserved seeds. A treasure trove of biological diversity. Infinite chains of DNA, each with their own potential uses. And from this gold mine, the Thais are extracting answers to their knottiest challenges of survival. With access to the Thai seed bank, Des Moines could mine genetic code for generations, beat back plague mutations, stay alive a little longer. Anderson shifts in his seat, stifling irritation, wiping away sweat. He's so close. Nightshades have been reborn, and now Gnaw. And Gibbons is running loose in Southeast Asia. If it weren't for that illegal wind-up girl, he wouldn't even know about Gibbons. The kingdom has been singularly successful at maintaining its operational security. If he could just ascertain the seed bank's location, a raid might even be possible. They've learned since Finland. Beyond the veranda, nothing with any intelligence is moving. Tantalizing beads of sweat run down Lucy's neck and soak her shirt as she complains about the state of the Cold War with the Vietnamese. She can't hunt for jade if the army is busy shooting anything that moves. Coyle's sideburns are matted. No breezes blow. Out in the street, rickshaw men huddle in thin pools of shade. Their bones and joints protrude from bare taut skin, skeletons with flesh stretched tight on their frames. At this time of day, they only suddenly emerge from shadow when they're called, and then only for double fee. The entire ramshackle structure of the bar is scabbed to the outer wall of a wrecked expansion tower. A hand-painted sign leans against one of the stairs up to the veranda, with the scrawled words, Sir Francis Drake's. The sign is a recent addition, relative to the decay and wreckage around it, painted by a handful of Farang determined to name their surroundings. The fools who did the naming long ago disappeared upcountry, either swallowed in the jungle, as blister rust rewrites swept over them, or torn apart in the tangle of war lines over coal and jade. Still, the sign remains, either because it amuses the owner, who has taken the name on as a nickname, or because no one can summon the energy to paint over it. In the meantime, it peels in the heat. Regardless of provenance, Drake's is perfectly placed between the seawall shipping locks and the factories. Its dilapidated wreck